I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, Professor Andre Merkowitz has written scholarly articles on subjects as varied as politics and soccer, anti-Semitism, and cultural anti-Americanism in European thought. He's also led a rather long and storied life, which he details in his new memoir, The Passport as Home, Comfort in Rootlessness. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the term rootless cosmopolitan, it's essentially an anti-Semitic dog whistle. But Andre has taken the idea of rootlessness and cosmopolitanism and tried to put a positive spin on it. He says that rootlessness gave him a degree of freedom, and that cosmopolitanism has been beneficial to him and his relationships. That's the launching point for our conversation on this edition of the show, as Andre Merkowitz joins us to discuss The Passport as Home, Comfort in Rootlessness. We'll also be discussing his relationship with the political scientist Karl Deutsch, the emergence of the Green Left in the 1970s, his relationship, a rather complicated one at that, with the left over the years, and much, much more in this freewheeling conversation. We even managed to talk a little bit about Andre's love of the Rolling Stones and his experience seeing the Stones as a young Jewish man in Vienna, which, I should add, had a very interesting fallout. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Andre Merkowitz, author of, again, the new memoir, The Passport is Home, Comfort in Rootlessness. Welcome to Parallax Views, Professor Andy Merkowitz, author of the book I'm holding in my hand right now, The Passport as Home, Comfort in Rootlessness. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good, good. And I was really fascinated by this book, especially the subtitle, Comfort in Rootlessness. And I guess you open up the book talking about that term rootlessness and also how it's been used as a sort of an anti-Semitic dog whistle, the term rootless cosmopolitanism. So what were you trying to do invoking this term rootlessness with your book?
Well, I was born in a world where this was a huge issue precisely when I was a little kid. I was born in 1948 in then Stalinist Romania, and rootless cosmopolitan was coined by Andrei Zhdanov, I think, in 1946, and it was very much part of Stalin's massively anti-Semitic campaign, which the Doctor's Plot is a very famous incident of this, namely, obviously, that the Jewish doctors were doing some heinous stuff to the regime. So basically, and there's also evidence that had this continued, certainly longer. I mean, Stalin dies in March of 1953. Had this continued, this could have easily led to some kind of massive arrest and even killing of Jews. And Jews were, of course, similarly to like on the right, Jews were really seen as suspicious entities by the Bolsheviks as well, even though so many of them were Jews, precisely because of their internationalism. So what this actually underlines is a very strong kind of tension within parts of the European left between its national and international dimensions. And so the word ruthless cosmopolitan just appeared and was used. And I remember even, you know, I think my father, when I was a little kid, I lived there until the age of 9, would occasionally even mention something like this, and certainly later. And then, you know, my studies at Columbia, this came up. I took a lot of courses on Eastern, on the left, and on Soviet politics, and so on and so forth. And it was very clear that by the time that I was a kid in Romania, this became a code word for Jews. And so that's what I'm using. I'm using this as a word for Jews, but I actually always loved being a ruthless cosmopolitan. So I'm using this pejorative term, which I ran it by a dear friend of mine who actually is now a very eminent professor at a German university and who grew up in East Germany. And when I asked him, whether in German it's wurzelloser or entwurzelter Kosmopolit, meaning it's like the French déraciné, entwurzelt or wurzelloser, like in English, rootless. He just literally said, oh, you mean as in Jews? And that just clinched it to me. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, was born much younger than I am. I think was born in the late 70s or mid 70s and grew up in the GDR. And so as a teenager, and he knew that the word, that this word meant Jews immediately. So clearly way after the Zhdanov incident, this became a code word for Jews. So that's why I'm picking up on this, because it really links to my, to when I was a little boy, and when this, in fact, was part of the Soviet credo, so to speak.
If we could, I wanted to talk about that for a bit, because you're actually the second guest I've had on to talk about this. I've also had on Emil Dreitzer, who worked at a Soviet satire magazine called The Crocodile. And he spoke a lot about the doctor's plot and anti-Semitism within the Soviet Union. Why did this sort of anti-Semitism arise in a country that was seen as sort of left-wing?
Oh, well, I mean, it's, I think, a myth to think that the left is not or doesn't have anti-Semitism in it. By the way, not only in the Soviet Union. I mean, it existed in the German social democracy. It existed, you know, everywhere. It existed in the British Labour Party, never mind the Corbynite Labour Party, but I'm talking about before, you know, Bevin and so on. Let's look at how the internationalism of the left starts. I mean, the internationalism of the left, of course, starts by Marx analyzing very correctly that capital, of course, is completely international, and that, in fact, labor is internationally exploited, which is completely correct. And he then deduces from that in fact, it can only be labor as an international agent that could actually overthrow this. So labor, he believed, and from, I think, his own experience, that indeed labor is always international because it's internationally exploited. But this, of course, does not mean that labor also has international consciousness. And basically what he realized, that, or what he concluded, is from his own émigré existence, which was indeed completely international. There were Germans and there were Russians and all kinds of other people who were part of the left who lived in England, the only place where they could live. This is wonderfully depicted in Tom Stoppard's the Coast of Utopia. This internationalism of the left, but the international of the left, which is so strong also in its beginnings, always had also a nationalist critique to it, and typically the clash was often between Jewish leftist intellectuals who were by their very bourgeois upbringing internationalists. They spoke languages, they traveled and so on, and often the trade union and workerist locals who actually were not international. And so there is this tension always between cosmopolitanism and localism, and that the Jews are more towards the cosmopolitan, more, by the way, towards the radical. So typically, very often, Jews are accused of being the more radical, the more irresponsible, the more ideological parts of the left, whereas it's the local left that is often associated with being much more trade unionist and so on, although this cuts both ways. So the fact that there is an uneasy relationship within the left towards Jews is very common. Jews as, what about Jewish nationalism? I mean, typically the Jewish nationalism was always spurned by the left. So typically the Bundists, who are very important in Eastern Europe, really kind of dismiss the Zionists as faux, as bourgeois ideologues, that in fact, the only nationalism that is seen as not acceptable is indeed Jewish nationalism, because it thereby is seen as reactionary. So the role of Jews and the left is a very, very, very difficult topic and very multifaceted. And it's not, unfortunately, being a man who always sympathized with parts of the left to this day, I always bemoan the fact that there is left-wing anti-Semitism and that it's not ipso facto logical that leftists would not be anti-Semitic. Unfortunately, they have been. So I mean, there's already, if you look at the purges, I mean, when Stalin consolidates his power after, above all, sort of the late 20s. The Yezhovchina, the blood trials of the 1930s are all directed against Jews. Kamenev, Zinoviev, all of these guys are Jews. And they're also, Stalin in many ways is the local leftist. He is precisely the anti-cosmopolitan leftist. And he hates these others because he sees them as not trustworthy, as having obviously various connections all over the world, et cetera, et cetera. So they can't be completely trusted. And this then accentuated with Stalin's paranoia, which becomes so strong right after the war. For example, I'm quite convinced that the guy whom I describe in the book, Yosef, the Soviet colonel who lives in our apartment, my father and I reconstructed this, and I'm quite certain that he was probably purged or done away with precisely because he served abroad and was seen as not reliable anymore. I mean, we don't know this. He just disappeared literally overnight, the morning, never came back. We have no idea. I actually love the guy, but the problem with internationalism, with cosmopolitanism, and the left is a very, very, very acute one. And always, on some level, the left is cosmopolitan, but on the other hand, it's also seen as very quickly as being a form of suspicion, of not quite being reliable, of being sort of ideologically self-serving and not in fact authentic with the working class, but really concerned much more with ideas, with being in a cafe, with being writing, et cetera, et cetera. And it's also a form of anti-intellectualism, which was very strong on the part of Stalinism. You know, it starts again in the 30s, but even maybe before. And you know, in some ways, I would argue even Stalin's wrath against Trotsky is a form of anti-intellectualism. And in fact, also a form of anti-cosmopolitanism, that Trotsky is seen as this international guy and, you know, who travels. And he, the wrath of Stalin has something to do with the fact that Trotsky is precisely one of these ruthless cosmopolitan Jews.
Now, in looking at this idea of rootlessness or cosmopolitanism, and, you know, kind of turning the trope on its head and saying, you know, maybe there's a virtue to rootlessness or cosmopolitanism, what would the virtue of rootlessness be? And I think that's actually the first chapter, is sort of the virtue of rootlessness.
Yes, the virtue of rootlessness for me, and I'm speaking very, very personally here. I just don't know whether, in fact, to most people, rootlessness is a virtue. I don't think so. By the way, I really think that we are very much wired to be somehow anchored into something. And what I'm just saying here in the chapter is that for whatever reason, I relished, you know, being this marginal person, you know, from my little childhood on. I was a Hungarian speaker in Romania. But within the Hungarian speaking community, I'm a Jew who also speaks German. And with the German community, of course, I'm a Jew. And then, of course, so it's all of these layers are ultimately a form of marginalization, which I actually experienced as immensely enriching. I did not see any of this as sort of hindering me or making me feel sort of homeless, or in fact, it's exactly the opposite. I mean, learning all these languages and also very much relishing the fact that I was different in some ways. Obviously, it's a form of security. Clearly, this form of rootlessness or kind of marginalization is in some ways more comforting in a very bourgeois environment that I grew up in. So in which there were no worries about material shortcomings. And I think what the book also mentions, there's only one hero, namely my father. So clearly his sort of boundless, really unconditional love for me made this rootlessness actually comforting. Without this love, who knows how it would have been. And it allowed me a certain form of comfort and playfulness, which I just relish to this day. I just gave I teach huge class on sports in the political science department, where this is completely anathema, and I just love it. Including, by the way, I think I'm sure this book. I mean, I'm on some level. I don't know this, by the way, for a fact, but I'm sure that on some level, writing such a book is seen as not kosher for an academic of my stature. I mean, this is. What on earth is this? And I don't care, but not only don't I care, I love it. So I think my point about rootlessness, I do not for one second mean to say that rootlessness in general is something to be coveted. I think rootlessness can be very dangerous or very problematic and very unsettling. But for me personally, it was not. And ultimately, I think it wasn't because of my father. And you read the book in a weird way for my finding a home, not in concrete America, but in my imagined America. In other words, it's my passport. I'm where am I home? At home. I'm at home in the United States of America. Do you mean Cambridge, Mass? No. Do you mean, California? No. I would like it to be an imaginary New York, but it's of course not. And so it's this That's what I mean with the passport. So that's why I carry the passport around everywhere, including today's lecture. I mean, the passport is, this American passport gives me this sort of grounding, which is insane because in fact, it's a document that is there for you to leave and to travel, not to be at home.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. Before we continue our conversation on this edition of Parallax Views, I want to notify California listeners of the program about one of our sponsors, the therapy practice of Alexander Yu. Yu is an experienced teletherapist since 2008, and he goes by the motto, flow, adapt, change, as Lao Tzu would say. And he wants to accompany you on your journey of self-improvement. Now, again, this applies to California listeners of the program. Alexander is a licensed psychotherapist and teletherapist. And if you'd like his services, then please contact him at Alexander Yu. That's Alexander, Yoo.com. And he can be reached by email at therapy@alexanderyu.com or by phone at 323-834-9828. That's 323-834-9828. This is only available once again to my California listeners, but if you need anything related to therapy needs, please be sure to contact our sponsor, Alexander Yu.
Now, there's a lot you learn to love in this sort of imagined America or the abstract America. What was your first experience, just for my listeners, of sort of American culture? What was your first brush with it?
Well, my first brush is actually on 4th of July, 1954, when I sit with my father in front of a radio, a Blaupunkt radio, I will never forget it, German-made radio, and we're listening to Hungary play West Germany for the FIFA World Cup, for the World Cup title. And the Germans win, one of the biggest upsets ever. And I noticed that my father is not particularly upset, even though we're speaking Hungarian, we're listening to Hungarian radio. And he, at some point, says to me, these are two bad nations or evil nations. And the only thing that is important for you is that this is the birthday of this country far away from here called the United States of America. You know, at this point, I'm 6 years old. I kind of, what? What is this? But I remember this was very important to me, that somehow there was this something there which was the golden Medina, to use a Yiddish word, the golden world, the golden country. And I kind of had some inkling of this by receiving occasional toy cars from my uncle, who after the Holocaust went to New York, and my father's elder brother. And so America to me was this mention of my father, and then of this golden something. And the only, you know, the only thing that I should take away from a match between Hungary and Germany is that it happens on the America's birthday. I mean, this is pretty abstract stuff for a six-year-old, but it really stayed with me. And the toy cars. And then, of course, ultimately, when we come in 1960, when we arrive in New York, and it's
the pink bubblegum story stood out to me.
Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, man. Mr. M. Oh, wow. By the way, I'm so touched that you read this and with such care. It's, amazing. Yeah, we arrive in New York after a very long trip, flying Tiger Line. Over 26 hours. We even land in Gander, I remember. which becomes important from for this wonderful Broadway show From Far Away, where you know, Gander becomes a major place for all these stranded airplanes that could not get into American airfields after 9/11. And we arrive in New York, and here is, at this point, we're emigrating here. I mean, we don't, there's no yet any talk about going back. So this is it, you're arriving, right? I mean, this is, and I'm nervous, and my father is nervous, and my English already was a tad better than his, because I had taken these English lessons from the from Mrs. Vago, as I describe her. I never knew her first name. I still don't, in Timișoara. And and then we come to this immigration officer, and you actually look up to, because they're kind of sitting a little in an elevated glass booth of sorts. And to me, until then, authority figures were immensely stark, scary, buttoned up folks, uniform, either Romanian policemen or Soviet generals or Viennese policemen. I never had seen an authority figure with an open shirt. And it was an open white shirt with an with t-shirts. And since then, I'm in love with these t-shirts, these crew, not the V-neck t-shirts, but the crew neck t-shirts. And there is this guy, and it says something on his white pocket. There's a name, I mean, which of course also was something unusual. I never had seen names on these. And it said something M. I wish I would ever, you know, Mangione, Macaroni, whatever, some Italian name with M. And he was blowing bubble gums, pink ones. And my God, I mean, this is heaven. I mean, here is this authority figure who has some name and is chewing bubble gum. And he has a transistor radio in his booth listening to something which I already construed as must have been baseball, because it couldn't have been soccer because Americans didn't listen to that. And, you know, so clearly here's this guy who's listening to a baseball game, and he is in charge of my life. He is in charge of whether we go in or not. And he was also happens to have been very kind to me. He, after doing stuff with my father, he actually gives me some form as well to carry into the next stop, which was basically the customs officers. And this is incredible. And I always wonder, I mean, you know, I wonder, had it been some nastier guy, what if this had been, you know, some nasty guy who had a bad night the night before, someone who is gruff, who would have been, you know, who knows? I mean, I cannot tell you what an inspirational thing this was. And for me to enter into this country with some guy who blows bubbles and is kind and gives me something to fill out to take with me, you know, to the next thing. And then in contrast to this, my uncle, who was this, I mean, I thought this uncle, you know, America, I mean, it was some kind of, you know, who sent me cars. This guy is some, I don't know, dashing, you know, fancy guy. And suddenly we see this beaten down old East European Jew who's shuffling and who hugs my father and who hugs me and who is clearly, I mean, again, you're at this time, I'm 10, go on 11. I sense that this guy had a lot of misery. It was very clear. And he was in such contrast to this sort of happy bubblegum guy. And then of course we hail a cab, and there comes the next America for me. Here is this African-American driver in a huge yellow car, you know, with all kinds of lettering on the side of the car. And, you know, this fin, you know, with some kind of a Chevrolet and it was a beautiful summer day. And he is the windows are open and he's one arming the car, and there is this amazing rock and roll blaring out of the car. And I'm sitting in the front with him, and he's talking to me, and I don't understand everything he's saying, but whatever he's saying is very cool, I think. And you know, and we're driving on the Triborough Bridge, and suddenly I see Manhattan and the sky, and so this is America.
I was going to add to that. I'm assuming you sort of imply this in that chapter, that there's probably a big difference between how you're viewing this as a young kid coming to America for the first time, and maybe how your dad is looking at all of this. You know, maybe he's looking at it as being, oh, this is the vulgarity of America and whatnot. Could you talk about that sort of compare and contrast?
Yeah, totally. To my father, especially a little later on, when we settle at the Hotel Ashley on 47th Street, just off 7th Avenue, and right in the middle of Broadway. I mean, you know, and Times Square, and I completely fall in love with this, and all the neon lights, and all of this, and the smoking women smoking cigarettes on the street, and to me this is sort of unbelievably cool and sexy, and to my father this is the end of civilization, and he finds this vulgar and scary, and he never said anything about the cab driver, but I'm sure he was threatened by the music that was blaring, and he just sat back in the back seat talking to my uncle, and here was the old world, the two brothers. Again, I never kind of gave it a lot of credit, but you know, this was the first time he had seen him since 48 or something, so clearly they had a lot of catching up to do. And he was never that close to him because there was a lot of age difference. My Uncle Alex was, I think, 12 years older than my father. So there was a lot of age difference. And, but yeah, this was, they had no relation to this, none. And certainly Alex didn't. And so it was like this completely different America. And to my father, he always, for the rest of his life, always loved American power, or loved America's standing in the world and America's role as the sort of the defenders of liberal democracy and of the West and all of this. But he never warmed. It was too late. He never warmed to the America that I warmed to, namely the American of rock and roll, of mass culture. Of he always found this very he found it to kind of odd. And even later on, when he comes to visit me a lot at Columbia and we go to lectures, he loves the professors, but he actually feels very ill at ease with long-haired folks like you and me, or, you know, in our earlier version. He just is not, this is not what he's comfortable with. I mean, he tolerates it because, you know, ultimately I become this also, and actually I do very well in school. And in some ways, I never rebel against my father. And I ultimately become, and that's sort of my, in some ways, something that I regret, that I really ultimately, yes, I talk a good game and I become a kid of the left and I support this and that and whatever, an anti-war and whatever, but ultimately I pass all my exams. I, you know, make sure that I don't have one incomplete, and I ultimately become a very established guy. And that gives me a lot of leeway with my father. So actually I could have long hair or, you know, follow the Grateful Dead, because it's actually fine, because ultimately you are a fine professor.
That's actually a good lead into where I wanted to go next. One of my favorite scenes in the book, and maybe you could describe it for my listeners, is you go to see a Rolling Stones show, I believe in Vienna, and yes, you go about it very sneakily, and it doesn't necessarily all end well.
Oh, God. This is so, I'm so happy that you read. Yes, this is 65. The Stones finally make it to Vienna. And see, again, maybe I should have to add to the listeners, in 1960, we stay in New York, but ultimately we go back to Vienna. And the reason for that is because my father, apropos what we just talked about, my father really gets scared about New York and American real life, American culture. Above all, he gets scared by the fact that no one gives a hoot about his being a doctor or Herr Doktor. Of course, not a medical doctor, but he has a PhD or a semblance of it. And everyone in Europe or in Central Europe, in this completely aristocratic world of Central Europe, everybody has a title. So, of course, you Herr Doktor, you this, Herr Master, Herr whatever. And this was very important to my father. And he realized that in New York, no one cares about what you have. And he becomes very disillusioned. And then, of course, the incident, and I have to talk about this, the incident when in a restaurant on Times Square, he invites a dear friend who he hadn't seen who emigrated via Cuba. And we take him out to dinner. And my father, of course, was a restless sort, and just like me. And above all, he also was a very status conscious guy, and he didn't want to stand in line. This you don't do as a Herr Doktor. You don't stand in line. And you
so he just tries to slip some money to the one waiter.
Yes. He tries to slip a $10 bill to the waiter, which he did constantly in Europe, in Romania and Vienna, with a panache, with wonderful, you know, wonderful sovereignty, with just flawlessness. He was just the master of this, because in fact he was secure culturally. But here in New York, it's not his turf, and he didn't. And what happens, horror, horrors. And by the way, as I'm telling you this, this will always give me the chills. He drops the money and the bill, and this is for all to see, the maitre d' and the other patrons waiting in line. Oh my God, I am convinced that this added massively to his decision to go back to Vienna and to ultimately then continue with his green card and have me come back to Vienna, go to this wretched school, and but spend every summer with my uncle in New York and then come here to college. And so this is very important, because it's through this experience that we go back to Vienna, but I actually never want to go back to Vienna, and I stay kind of culturally constant in America. Now, fast forward, what does that mean? That I obviously in Vienna become a huge rock and roll fan. And I listen to Radio Luxembourg, the station of the stars, London W1. I listen to the Beatles, the Stones, all of this, in late at night. And also American Forces, AFN, American AFN, American Forces Radio. I got it wrong now, but basically the American Army's radio in Germany, which I listen to all the time. And the Stones are finally coming to Vienna, and it's 1965, and I want to go. And of course, my father would just never, you can't go to the Rolling Stones. He already hated the Beatles, but the Stones were worse. I mean, the Stones were not even cute. The Stones were just threatening. And so even though when he sees my first LP, he sees Mick Jagger's name. And he starts going, Jäger. Ah. And I said, Dad, no, he's not Jewish. And immediately said, no, Jäger, this is not a normal English name. And I said, it's not Jäger, Dad, it's Jagger. It's J-A-G-G-R. And he never, to his dying day, always somehow thought that Mick Jagger was somewhere Jewish. I mean, it's ridiculous. I finagle a friend of mine has tickets to go, and I somehow I was giving English I was tutoring kids in younger than I was in English at various Viennese schools for little money, and my English already was superb because I spent every summer in New York, so my English was much better than your normal Austrian kids. And I somehow, to this day, I never know why my father believed me. I somehow said that, look, tonight I have this particular gig. I want to teach this guy. And he said, yeah, of course. Kind of made no sense, because 12-year-olds didn't have evening tutorials. But so I go to the concert, and the concert is sensational. And
I have to ask you, this was one of the concerts where Brian Jones was still, yes, I think, in the band. What was Brian Jones like? He's one of my favorite musicians of all
time. Okay, well, Brian, if you read the book really careful, I actually really fall for Brian Jones. First of all, he's wearing this white suit, completely white. kind of shortish pants. I mean, the pants are a little bit sort of like an intellectual, shortish pants, white sneakers or something. He was completely white. And if I recall correctly, he was much more prominent on the guitar that concert than Keith Richards was, or at least I perceived him to be more prominent on the guitar. Always a two guitar band. So I was very impressed by Brian Jones and his long blonde hair than I was by Keith Richards. But that's, who knows? So I was very impressed by him. The Stones end with Satisfaction and, rousing thing. And I walk home, and this is not very far from where we were living at the time. And this is, 10:30, 11, Vienna. This is a town at a time when Vienna shut down at 8. I mean, it was literally completely nothing in the streets. And I just go and really sing Satisfaction, in, like crazy, and imagine all these beautiful girls, pining away from below, watching me. I'm, of course, Jagger in this. And I sing, when I'm driving in my car and the man comes on the radio and all of this. And suddenly I kind of find myself very close to our apartment building. And who should exit from a parked vehicle but my father? Literally, 5 feet away from me. And I freeze. And he smacks me. I mean, big time. The only time he ever hit me. And we didn't talk for a long time. This was, I think, on a Wednesday, not until Saturday. What really rescued me was our love for soccer. And we ultimately went to our obligatory soccer match every Saturday or Sunday in Vienna. We went to all the grounds. And ultimately that affinity or male bonding comes out. And to the rescue, Vienna's most important newspaper, showing a photograph of the Rolling Stones, Jagger and Jones and Keith Richards, and I think Charlie as well, probably, and Bill Wyman, sitting at a table in a Viennese restaurant with two very attractive young women who happened to have been part of the Jewish community and were in fact part of the Orthodox Jewish community. And this was, I cannot tell you what an unbelievable scandal this was in the small Jewish community in Vienna, which already was completely ghettoized and worried and post-Holocaust and traumatized and on and on and on. And here,
and these girls' parents would have been even more conservative.
Oh, my God. This actually gets me off the hook, because here are these girls who actually go out with these thugs. I just went to their concerts. I am dying of jealousy, of envy, clearly knowing that the only reason they got to see them is because they wear miniskirts and they're girls and attractive, and I'm not. By the way, I never, ever, ever asked them. One of them went to religion class with me. I will never divulge her name. And actually, I asked her. I've contacted her when I wrote the book during COVID, whether I could actually, and she said no. This, by now, she's a multiple grandmother, of course. And I asked her, I said, don't you think that it's actually a form of distinction that you actually spent an evening with Jagger? I mean, isn't this sort of cool? I don't know, 60 years later? And she said, yeah. But anyway, this was a huge scandal. And she told me that her father really, really beat her. I mean, badly. I mean, this was bad stuff. And, to transgress this way. And, so that's the Rolling Stones. That's why I titled the chapter, "The Rolling Stones Play Vienna to the Physical Detriment of the Jewish Community," because I was smacked. And this young woman was actually beaten up by her religious father for transgressing. And so, yeah, this is the Rolling Stones incident.
In regards to the whole issue of pop culture within your memoir, you know, I think the sort of conflicts between an older generation and a newer generation, they still ring true to this very day. You know, there's always a new moral panic. You know, there was a moral panic about video games. There was a moral panic about Elvis Presley and heavy metal later on. And, you know, I think today we have moral panics about, oh, the kids having, pink hair, or the kids reading CRT in schools. And what do you think about these sort of moral panics and what they say about the generation gap? Do you think we'll ever get beyond maybe these sort of panics that get really over the top in a lot of ways?
No, I think it's endemic to human nature. I don't think we'll ever get. I mean, I have no idea. Actually, interesting that you should say. Kiki and I don't have kids, so we don't really experience. I actually don't know what the panic is, whether it's about TikTok or, I mean, clearly there are some forms of justified panic that, you know, obviously the internet is open to, predators or stuff like. But the fact that there's always this fear of cultural of undermining authority or the fear of a form of threatening, I think this is it's par for the course. I don't see this in any way different at all. It's just the manifestation is different. So clearly in the 50s it was Elvis Presley and before that I had a wonderful student who wrote in the process of writing a great dissertation of how jazz and rock were both, of course, hated as American intrusions in the 1950s. Jazz in the 1920s, rock in the 1950s, and constructed in the very same way as, you know, America undermining the essence of German beauty and real culture. So this is very common. And I'm not at all surprised. I experienced it myself. Although, as I say, what is so interesting is that then in '82, my father and I go to a Rolling Stones concert in Madrid, and this is also wonderful because, of course, I buy tickets, and my father sheepishly sort of says something. You know, do you think I could come with you? I said, Dad, yes. But at this point, he's 72, which means he is my age now. I have some insight about the generations in a minute, but let me just finish the story. And I said, sure, I'd love for you to come. And he said, do you think I'll fit in there? I mean, how will this be? Is it like... The only thing that he came up with is like you once went to Louis Armstrong concert. I said, it's a little different. Or maybe Sammy Davis Jr. I said, no, it's also, but it's maybe closer to Sammy Davis Jr. and Louis Armstrong than your normal classical music to which you always go to. And there, of course, I also had a lot of legitimacy to my father because I also love classical music and I've always been very at home with that. I buy the tickets and we go see it in this huge stadium, not the Real Madrid stadium, but the Atletico Madrid stadium. And there was a huge downpour, massive downpour just before it was actually the Jay Giles band opened up for them, the Jay Giles band. And it was wicked hot, 100, 120 degrees. They sprayed the helicopter, sprayed the attendees with water, and because it was very brutal. And the Stones come out after the downpour, already is dark, and they come up with these see-through ponchos, and they go into an unbelievably driving version of Under My Thumb. And it was just amazing, absolutely amazing. And my father actually kind of liked them, or he all the threat that they represented in 1965 was completely gone. And it was gone by virtue of by this time, I'm already, thriving assistant professor at Wesleyan University. So I'm all set. And he just doesn't care. And or he actually is not worried that the stones or whatever the stones stand for will derail Andy or will derail Andy and bring him to a, you know, bad conclusion. That's what. So the stones become this, you know, just interesting experience for him. Oh, what I meant by the generation question, I think this is an interesting insight, although I only address it marginally in the book. I think, interestingly, in the 1960s, something happens, or the late 60s, and which is my generation. There is the end of what I call the Victorian bourgeois culture, which you didn't have before. And it literally changes everything, the way we relate to amongst ourselves, how we relate to the weak, how we, all of it. And which is, I think, fundamentally revolutionary. And above all, it also creates a form of permanent youth. I mean, it would have been unthinkable for professors pre-68 to behave and look the way I do now. And even a couple of weeks ago, I will go in and teach in a Manchester United t-shirt and shorts. And I don't lose legitimacy to my students, meaning it's in fact, if anything, maybe they even think it's cool or something, but I just don't care. I do it. And so the point is that this form of extended youthfulness in culture is indeed a very much a legacy of the 60s, and it didn't exist before, where, you know, the way we dress, the way adults now dress like children, or they're, you know, short pants, all of this. And this actually alters, I think, the former sort of hiatus between youth and non-youth culture. In other words, I always think that the big divide is sort of 63, 64, 65. I think Quentin Tarantino had it right. The world divides between Beatles people and Elvis people. And the Beatles people are people who get their BA after 65, 66, 67. And I have in many ways a lot more in common, even with my students today who were born in 2002 on some weird level, than I do with someone who actually, a colleague with whom I had sort of an outdoor lunch today, who got his BA in 62, who really, to whom any of this that you and I talk about, the dead, you know, stones or all this, like literally completely alien. So to him, it's not only the stones who are alien, but so is Lady Gaga, or so is on and on. So I think that the 60s open up a kind of permanent youthfulness, which can also be seen as very bad. I mean, sort of, you know, that, hey, come on, Andy, grow up. I mean, you should not be teaching, you know, in shorts and a Manchester United or a Grateful Dead t-shirt to your class on, you know, German politics or comparative politics, you know. So I think your point about, so that's why I think there's a greater conversation, you know, between today's parents and former ones, I think, at least in my class. I don't know how much this is affected by class and by milieu, but certainly, you know, I think that this is more correct or more prevalent today.
So speaking of the 60s, I wanted to get into your time with the Students for a Democratic Society. And those are very turbulent years. I mean, people always talk about 1968, which, yeah, you know, there were, you know, what happened in Chicago, what happened in France. It was a big year, especially for the left. And also I wanted to get into your relationship with the left, because your relationship with the new left has been a complicated one.
Oh, God. We need more than an hour. Look, 68 is, as I say, 68 to me is the hiatus. If you were to ask me culturally speaking, what is the most important divider of the 20th century? It is 68. It's bigger than, I mean, if not maybe 1918, because it's the end of World War I, it's the end of feudalism, the end of the aristocratic world, and so on, certainly. But 68 changes the Victorian notion of the family, of sexuality, everything. Women's liberation, all of this is six or started in 68. And Colombia is crucial in this. I mean, Colombia actually happens before Paris. I mean, I don't know where to begin. Maybe let's begin by the fact that I wanted to participate, but participated only up to a point, partly because I was prevented structurally from being more, because I was not a citizen yet. And my father's immigration lawyer called me when the building, when Hamilton Hall was taken over by students and later, of course, by African-American students very quickly, and the whites left or were asked to leave. Attorney Blau, I will never forget it, said something like, don't you dare be arrested by the cops because, you know, you will be deported and you will lose your, and you will not return, I mean, 10 years or whatever it was. And I forget, in fact, as I include in the book, I will never forget it, the way he put it. It's something like, until you're, you know, until when you're a citizen, then you can demonstrate with these commie bastards. Until then, you can't do it, son. Not yet. Okay. And this had clearly an effect on me, meaning that I was worried about participating in demonstrations and takeovers of buildings, you know, even though I was sort of marginally, I was there, you know, after the cops came and so on. But more centrally, I think, I was, I misread in some ways this whole thing at the time. I saw it as a good European kid, as an intellectual endeavor. I was somehow occasionally upset by what little marks some of these SDS guys knew, and whether they were really up on their social theory. And I was sometimes surprised how little history they knew. And when I would mention something about Prague, they would look at me like, what, Prague? What are you talking about? I said, you know, there's a very important movement going there in the Czech Republic. What about this? And they just like, this is... So, and I, maybe even threatened by it culturally, I very quickly thought that a lot of this was basically to chase girls, to put it crudely. Or in other words, that this was more about culture, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, rather than sort of, you know, having study groups on Grundrisse and, you know, debating, you know, when is this the early Marx or the late Marx? So what does this really mean? And, you know, and how do you see the third world? Is it really part of a Marxist? Is it Leninist? What's the role of imperialism? All of this stuff. And I was completely wrong. And so to me, I actually also fled into that intellectualism precisely because I could not participate in the actual politics of it and the actual takeover, which I didn't because of Attorney Blau, and my being arrested would have been my end of America, no question. But also because in some ways I was threatened by it. I really thought that I was not up to being as cool as these guys, or as you know, that I could not woo this attractive Barnard girl by being, you know, being a cool guy, you know. And so I kind of used this as a refuge. And so I was I always had a kind of an uneasy relationship, which also was manifested itself in the fact that I was totally against the war in Vietnam. I always was very critical of American imperialism or of capitalism, but I always was very, very wary of dictators in national liberation movements. I always found this somewhat disturbing. And the left, in the Western left, for my liking, never really, I mean, there are some exceptions, of course, never really, really confronted this. Never really confronted Pol Pot, never really confronted, the horrors of the Khmer Rouge. In fact, to this day, really the attraction of the third world allows the left too much of a leeway. I mean, even now, look, I don't see enough leftists really decrying the Taliban. I mean, are there, I don't know of any, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know of any, women's studies movements or whatever that actually have come out condemning the Taliban the way they have condemned the Israelis, okay? Regularly in the last campaign against the Palestinians, you know, with Hamas. Fine, but it's too forgiving under the correct critique of the horrors created by the First World, and in first in line, of course, the United States. There is too much leeway given to ugly events. I was against the war in Vietnam. I demonstrated, but I never felt comfortable with extolling Ho Chi Minh. You know, Ho Chi Minh and others had some very, ugly dimensions to them. They had brutal secret polices. They were brutal. Okay. And that cannot be all, it can't be excused the way the left always has, either by not mentioning it at all or actually even exculpating it as a necessary form in the struggle against imperialism. And I just feel that this is a problem for me. And so that has always given me a very sort of often uneasy relationship with the left, with whom I actually identify with lots of other things on environment and certainly sexual politics and all of the other things.
I was just going to add, I even think I've read some of your statements on foreign policy and talking about the issue of anti-Americanism. And I like how you're very pointed in saying, you know, critiquing U.S. foreign policy is very different than what you're talking about in your examination of anti-Americanism. So I would even say that you've been very critical of things like Bush's war in Iraq.
Yes, yes. But I am also critical of people immediately associating, anything American as inferior. So it's my argument is about cultural anti-Americanism. And, you know, we can go into that as well, because I've published a book on that, which is translated in a number of languages and but very controversial. But I argue that there's a very difference, a great difference between critiquing what America does as opposed to what America is. And so that's what, and I actually even mentioned this a little bit in the memoir. But so back to 68, very much identify with a lot of it. I'm very close to the former foreign minister of Germany, Joschka Fischer, who was a key 68er and a street fighter. But to me, it's ultimately about the essence of democracy or liberal democracy. And this means also the form of dissent in any context, including that of the third world, and including in the struggle against imperialism, you have to account for a form of dissent, and you cannot stifle that. And so that's my problem with it. And this became very obvious to me already in 68. Although my worries were more about not being able to culturally participate in it the way I thought I wanted to. And then, of course, there's this wonderful, I think, a wonderful vignette when I tried to cheat on a midterm exam in microeconomics. And I come from Vienna, the Viennese Gymnasium, where cheating was absolutely endemic. Everyone cheated on the exam. You had to cheat, but of course, cheating was collective. You cheated not only for yourself, but in order to help others who were not good enough in that field. And it was, in fact, endemic and very, very expertly done. And if anything, whenever we had these tests, we had extra faculty come to supervise us so that we not cheat. And so when I come to my first exam at Columbia, this guy gives us the blue books and he gives us the problem set and he walks out. I will never forget this, 1501 microeconomics. This to me was insane. There's a teacher who walks out on us, and I literally thought, I'm not seeing right. What do you mean he's walking out on us? And I look around and nobody is talking to each other. They just continue to work on the sets. And I turn to my next neighbor and I whisper something that he should help me with one of the formulae or whatever. And another chill that will always accompany me, just like when my father dropped the $10 bill, this guy looks at me with the contempt and hatred, which I will never forget. But basically, you scum, how dare you do this? How dare you subvert the honor code? And above all, you scum, you're in damn Columbia. What's the matter with you? You're at Columbia. You are dumb, not smart enough to solve this. I was so upset by this that, in fact, it's the only exam to this day that I failed royally. I could not do anything for the rest of the hour. And then when he handed in his blue book, I will never forget, first of all, he had sort of longish hair like you and I now, but at the time, long hair, and he had an SDS button on his jacket. And I kind of go, my God, SDS, isn't that all about, you know, social justice and redistributive justice? And isn't it there to kind of help your fellow student against the evil faculty? Because the concept at a European educational setting was that the faculty were the evil and the students were the collective that you had to help. You know, it was us against them, and the them were the professors. And here is this guy who, rather than helping me, puts me down. And I would just never forget that. I just, it was just one of those lasting memories that will never, never disappear. You know, the guy with the SDS button, I wish I could remember, you know his name. And I don't know, who knows, maybe become an investment banker. Maybe he's a major surgeon. I have no idea who he is, but he certainly frightened me and made it very clear to me that even in the SDS, ultimately, when it comes to grades and it comes to competition, it's man against man. Or human against human, and we don't. There's no solidarity there. Okay. In other words, I want my A, and I don't want you to have your A.
So, before we close out, I had maybe two more major questions. The first, and you know, I was really interested. It's closer to the end of the book than the beginning, but you talk about Karl Deutsch and a thing called the Club of Rome report. I believe it was called the Limits of Growth Report.
Yes.
You were sort of in the thick of it for that. For people that don't know, what was the Club of Rome and what was Karl Deutsch's reaction to it?
Oh, wow. Okay. The Club of Rome was a consortium that wrote a fascinating, very, very, very important paper called On the Limits of Growth, which was published, I think, in 73, but you can check it in the book, or 74, 73, 72, maybe even. And so, say, apropos 68, this is all about 68. What happens in 68 is that the whole logic of growth, the whole logic of growth, which is so essential to all of, by the way, not only capitalism, but to the old left. To the old left, it's all about growth. You grow. I mean, that's what Marx is. It's Marxism and Lenin. It's all about growing. And then the social democrats redistribute. The Leninists take over. But it's all about the assumption is that you grow. You actually build and grow and grow. And above all, also the importance of technology. Everything was, you know, the largeness, all of it. The old left is all about dams. The new left is all about snail darters that you protect against these dams. It's a completely different set of how you think. And so the limits of growth, just like Silent Spring, published a decade before, is the first sort of manifesto that says, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Wait a minute, it's not all about growth. It's in fact about smallness or not growth. And so it's not only, you know, California hippies and various others who already, even in Germany, various people, tree huggers who start talking about no growth, but in fact, these high powered economists and political scientists who formed this club and who actually talk about how the growth needs to be limited.
They're essentially saying that infinite growth on a finite planet is, you know, folly.
Yes, 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 absolutely. They're actually saying that this will lead, yes, it's very, very apropos today, but they're the first to raise it in some ways. So the Silent Spring. And basically that, you know, by the way, this exists, of course, way before, but typically, it was typically the romanticist right, not the left, that raised it. Okay, it was the romanticist right, which was into nature. It was the Van der Vogel. It was actually, I always felt very uneasy about the new left in this, especially in Germany. I always say, whoa, too much nature for me. To me, nature is something potentially nefarious and has potential dimensions of blood and soil and the German forest and all of this. So don't give me nature. I'm an old leftist. Give me growth. I want dams. I want bigness. I want electrification. As Lenin, I want this stuff. Okay. I believe in technology. Technology is all good. Ernst Bloch, the great German Marxist theorist, was a huge advocate of nuclear energy, the clean energy. And so, in fact, the Austrian Social Democrats are totally into nuclear energy and then are completely hit upside the head in the early 70s when suddenly the left literally under their feet, okay? And the same with the German Social Democrats suddenly are questioning growth. And this is the beginning of the Greens. The Greens are the new left that say, wait a minute, social democracy, wait a minute, communism. No, it's not about growth. In fact, it's not about technology. It's exactly the opposite. So it's in that context that the limits of growth was written, although not from a Marxian point of view, not even part of the new left, but in a very, quantitative, very, very good, solid statement. And this leads to a major debate about, is this the proper global model or is it not? And this, of course, is at a time when under the influence of Vasily Leontiev, an input-output model, and of course, the rise of computers is very important. This is when it's very sexy to kind of create macro models in terms of predicting economic outcomes by virtue of social interaction, okay? That's what the Club of Rome did. And the Club of Rome basically saying Dennis Meadows, Donella Meadows, and the other two authors, I forget now, one of them with a very nice Danish name, but the two Meadows who were professors at Dartmouth College, are the authors of this. And this spawned the whole debate in the so-called global modeling world, namely, how do you see these, how do you see the world? I mean, literally, can you put into this into these models as many indicators as you can? And Karl Deutsch is really a universal genius, and I had the fortune of working with him and becoming very, very, very close to him personally, and I'm still very close to his two daughters. And Karl Deutsch hired me at the time to be his sort of gopher and secretary in a conference that he organized at Harvard in 1976, in which he brought together all these global modelers, people who were, he brought together the Club of Rome people, but also the Bariloche model. There was a very interesting, which is in Argentina, by a scholar whose name I forget now, it's Carlos, German last name, who is very important in this place called Bariloche, which is this beautiful alpine region in Argentina, with this institute that actually argues against the Club of Rome people.
And my understanding is Carl, from what you wrote, was sort of put off by how pessimistic the Club of Rome was.
Yes. Carl is he's actually not for Bariloche, but for different reasons. Carl was the eternal optimist. Carl was just the rare sunshine. I just adore the man. And he was really such a sweet man. He was, as I say, had a socialist soul. He really had a socialist soul. He knew nothing about status. Some kid, an undergraduate, stopped in the middle of Harvard Square at 20 below zero on our way to the dean, and this is actually a true incident, and asked him something about Nigerian parties and how they relate. Carl stopped and didn't care about the cold, and didn't care that it was late with the dean meeting. He just would go on and on and on. He was really a complete... just an amazing man. I mean, really no sense of arrogance, none. And that's why he was also so loved. He was just smarter than everybody in the room. But no one experienced it when he just went off on tangents and really just expunged. No one said, you know, this is grandstanding. This is completely... you know, outrageous, he's talking too much. People just loved it. And Carl was an optimist. Carl really believed, he was the last man of the Enlightenment. He was actually always a big social democrat also.
I guess very critical of Adorno and Horkheimer and the dialectic of the Enlightenment.
Yes, because they're absolutely, oh boy. He saw they were. He also thought that they were too much. There was too much babble there. He just never. He was too more of a concrete guy. Even though, of course, he knew all the. He even knew them quite well. And he also was part of the Austro-Marxism, but I can't get into that. But his uncle was the head of the Schutzbund, which was the Austrian Social Democratic Party's private army. And 1934 to 1938, and Carl's uncle, he came to Vienna every summer from Prague, and actually told me a lot about his uncle. And so Carl, yes, you're very right. He was always very skeptical of Adorno and Horkheimer, and also the Frankfurt School. He thought that they were way too pessimistic, and he believed rightly, I think, on some ways rightly, he believed that knowledge and learning and also technology in some ways will always ultimately enhance happiness, put crudely. And so in that wonderful volume published about 3 or 4 years ago about the great thinkers, where these three people asked me, it's all about interviewing people who, of course, are Hobbes, Locke, all of them long dead. And how people were asked to interview them as if it were today. And the authors, they were real giants, Plato, Marx, Locke, I mean, major, Hannah, and one of them was, of course, Karl Deutsch, and they asked me to interview Deutsch today. And my interview about him was all about the iPhone, and Karl would have just loved the iPhone. I mean, that would have been his transformation, because he always dreamt about how one can actually, because he was a data guy. He wanted to always know as much as possible and have it all in your hands. And, you know, suddenly you have the iPhone and all of this knowledge is literally in your hand. I think he would have loved it. So my interview with him is about the iPhone. So Carl Deutsch was had a major effect on me. He was very optimistic. And also, as in the Harvard Minutes, it was so aptly put about his death. Carl was always late, but ahead of his time. He always was late, precisely because he never cared about any kind of deadline, because someone stopped him and they asked him something about, 14th century Switzerland, and he would just know all the stuff. It was a phenomenal guy and just the honey of a man. He will never be replicated. Yes.
So go on.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's it about the Bariloche model and the globe of the Club of Rome. But I was actually very much in it by virtue of Carl Deutsch. And we published a book called Problems of Global Modeling, of World Modeling, and which is the only book where all of these global models are together or are collected and presented to the world. Yes, that's the global modeling.
So the reason I brought that up, and this is sort of the tie it all up question, you know, I think we're facing a lot of crises that we've been facing for a long time, right? The Club of Rome was talking about ecological crisis back in the 70s. And now we're, you know, I think closer to the edge of that problem than ever before. And I also think that we're facing this issue, and I think it's very important to put it in this way, is, you know, people will look at the rise of Trumpism in the United States and think that's purely an American phenomena. But we see a resurgent, very nativist, I would say, right wing globally right now.
Yes.
And it worries me because I think there is a value to cosmopolitanism. I just had Richard Falk from Princeton on a while back talking about his book, and he called his book Citizen Pilgrim, because he thinks we should all try to be sort of citizens of the world, pilgrims of the world. And I really admire that cosmopolitanism, whatever disagreements I might have with him, or we may have disagreements on certain things politically. But I think cosmopolitanism is important. Do you think that there's hope for a more cosmopolitan world going forward?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I actually see... very much so. I'm actually about cosmopolitanism, I'm very much taken with Kwame Appiah's work, the NYU philosopher who talks about cosmopolitanism and counter-cosmopolitanism. Again, being a Deutschian, I don't see this. Yes, of course, there will always be backlashes. And Trump, and of course, it's a backlash. But if you really look at let's just look at the United States. I see a phenomenal enlightenment also countering this. I mean, through Black Lives Matter, there is a major approach to including African Americans like never before. I mean, the Metropolitan Opera just opened with the first Black composer at the Met. And there are many other instances in which I think there is an opening and an inclusion. And ultimately, that's what cosmopolitanism really is. It's a form of inclusion, which is, I think, very much on the agenda and is ultimately will triumph. I don't see that. Of course, there will be backlashes always. If there's cosmopolitanism, there's counter-cosmopolitanism. There will be people who want to actually oppose changes, the people who don't want to include. But I think that to me, the trend is even, the trend even in ultimately, look at Germany, for example. I mean, the AfD was this very scary party, a counter-cosmopolitan party, and they're now down to 10%, which doesn't mean that they've disappeared. Look, every liberal democracy has basically about 20% or 25% of its population, which is in ways sort of at least tacitly, if not even actively, authoritarian. It just is, and very questioning of anything kind of our questioning of cosmopolitanism, or questioning of kind of democratic inclusion. And that would be there. But I do not see them triumphing at all. I mean, look, there is a major reforms in the United States in terms of these two Biden initiatives of really changing America in the sense of kind of creating a new deal. Will it go through? Maybe not totally, but it's in nascendo. It's in statum nascendi. And I think so. Just I mean, who's to say? But I would like to counter your pessimism here. I'm very optimistic about ultimately cosmopolitanism really triumphing. And there will always be challenges, never easy. It will always create sort of a backlash, no question. But the tendency, the spiral, it's a spiral. It's never a straight line, but the spiral, I would argue, is towards greater inclusion, greater participation by hitherto non-participating groups. People of different sexual orientation, all of this. I mean, think about this. Think about where the United States stood even 10 years ago or 12 years ago, but the issue of gayness or homo. I mean, this was, now it's of course nowhere close to equal, but in fact, it's not a taboo anymore. I mean, you really see it's a greater form of acceptance. This should not be dismissed. I mean, I see this as a major improvement of what it means to be normally American. I mean, now you see ads where men hold hands, or this is unthinkable not so long ago, literally not so long ago. And so I don't see the pessimism.
No, I actually would agree with you on that. I think, too, that as we face this problem of ecological crisis, I think people understand, and I think this has essentially come through with COVID, I think people understand that, we can have our individual sense of expression and, individuality, but we also don't have to live in a world where there isn't cooperation and we're not, I think we're moving towards a world where people understand the value of cooperation coupled with a sense of individuality.
Yes, I think I agree with you. I mean, the ecological crisis is a bit different because there the opponent is not only us, but in fact, literally the physical world. And that makes it harder because you can't, it's not purely a social phenomenon. Which you can actually more control about, how we relate to gays or African Americans, so it's all about us. With the ecology, it's not totally all about us. I mean, it's always what we do to the earth, but clearly the earth responds. So it's actually a bit harder. But even there, I agree with you. I think it spawned a kind of form of cooperation, which will, whether it will ultimately triumph and stop this, I don't know. I'm not a geologist, and I can't predict that. I have no idea. And ultimately, in some ways, it's actually irrelevant at my age for me. But because it will not affect me. But I don't mean to be selfish about this. I hope it will affect people like yourself and others who are much younger very positively. But it's all good. I mean, I'm very, as I say, I think the book in some ways is also very optimistic. It's a very optimistic book. And
I would say it's a very joyous book.
Thank you. It is, actually. And even though there was pain and stuff, but it's actually a joyous book. And I'm, I think I it's a very, it's genuinely so. I mean, in other words, I didn't write it to put on airs. I that's how I feel. You know, this has been a, you know, I've had a very, very good life. And I'm tremendously grateful for that, you know.
So I know I said I was going to let you get going, but I had one more really brief question because you didn't really cover it in the book, but you mentioned it in passing. I think you said near the end of the book that you had an encounter with Zbigniew Brzezinski while you were at Columbia and yeah. You weren't that impressed with him. Are you open to talking about that? Because Brzezinski comes up a lot in my show.
I mean, yeah, he just struck me. Let me put it this way. He's the exact opposite of Deutsch. Okay. I mean, I was assigned to him as his advisee in the PhD program. And, I remember after my first semester when I got three A's, in my colloquia. And so I go into my advisor and just tell him, dear advisor, I did this, you know, like, which actually most people don't do, but I was kind of, you know, good boy that I am. I've studied all this in Theresianum in Vienna, being a good schoolboy, you do this. And I remember he kind of looked at me and said, oh, no big deal. I got four A's at McGill University. And just the whole, he was sort of very snide. And we just didn't hit it off. I thought he was arrogant and snide to me. And brilliant guy, no question. I mean, I don't know who will, but brilliant guy, no question about this. A great writer, but actually in some ways, not enough of an intellectual for me.
He had a very, I think the Deutsch comparison is very apt because I think, and this isn't necessarily bad or good, but I think he had a very cold approach to how he thought about geopolitics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can assure you that Deutsch and Brzezinski, had they overlapped at Harvard, which they actually did not anymore, because I think Brzezinski left for Columbia when Deutsch arrived at Harvard from Yale. You know, they would have not been friends. I mean, not enemies, because Deutsch didn't have any enemies. I mean, or what did I say? I'm sure he did have enemies, but he would have never said anything. Deutsch was such a sweet guy that what I said about Brzezinski to you, he would have never said. And not only because he was a diplomat, but because he didn't feel it. He would have said something like, oh, you know, he was a bit too this or that. But, you know, he would have never said, you know, he treated me snidely or whatever. Deutsch would have not, it would have not registered with him.
All need to be a little bit more like Carl Deutsch. And on that note, I just want to promote the book again. The Passport is Home, Comfort in Rootlessness. Thank you again, Andy Markovitz, for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really a great honor for me. I'm very, very serious. And thank you so much. Means a lot to me, big time.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Andre Markovitz, author of the new memoir, The Passport as Home, Comfort in Rootlessness. I thought it was a fascinating conversation. You may not agree with everything that Andre says, but I think he has a lot to offer in terms of his experiences and some of his thoughts on a variety of issues, and hopefully we'll be able to have him back on the show again in the future. As always, if you can, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's a $1, $5, $10, and $15 tier. At the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout out. So it's that time again, producer's credit shout outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Gunner, Ed, Gratz, James, Mickey, Brian, The Warnerd, The 42 Group, Nick, Emilia, Chase, Chris, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, David, Holland, Martin, Stu, and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, join those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers. And of course, at the $5 tier, you get exclusive bonus content. Right now, I'm working on a series about the covert history of George H.W. Bush and the Bush family dynasty. It's comprised of what was around a five-hour conversation with the blogger These Long Wars, who previously appeared on such programs as Radio War Nerd and The Michael Brooks Show, Rest in Power, Michael. And part one of that series is now up on the Patreon for the $5 tiers and above at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.